Good morning. Does anybody recognize that SNL skit? Had you heard of that before? Anybody recognize before looking it up? A couple people did, so we have a few in there. I'm an SNL junkie and fan from way back, and I'm one of those people that believe I think you can find an SNL skit for just about everything. And when I was thinking about this week's talk, and when I was thinking about the heat, the tensions that come around this time of the year, I was reminded of this particular skit, which it's worth going on YouTube and looking it up if you haven't already. I think it was 99, 2000. It was Sherry O'Terry. Her character, she played somebody called Nadine, who would get very worked up at people trying to do simple things, such as returning things to the store. And for people who were not worked up, she would tell them to Simadonna. And she would repeat that over and over, and the people who were very calm began to get very worked up, as she would repeatedly tell them to Simadonna, Simadonna. And I was thinking about that with our politics, our everything about the way that we're functioning in society, and especially on these gosh darn election years. There's part of me, the conflict avoidance part of me, that just wishes that we could just kind of fast forward through all this. I have friends, we have a Canadian friend that we spent some time caravanning in our RV couple winters ago with. And we were sitting around a campfire one night, and he was telling us, he's like, why do you get so worked up about all this? He's like, you have news stations and commentators and people that you make obsessing about politics a national pastime. You talk about it, you think about it, it infuses all of your interactions, and it's true. And for those of us, like myself, who tend to operate in the ethereal realms of philosophy, it's easy for me to say that we need to turn the temperature down and leave the bigger problems to the political consultants, those who are trying to figure out what to do with our country after this. I don't have the political acumen. I don't have the money to run for politics. But what I do know is that we each have the opportunity to, and I'm going to say something that is way overused, and it's on way too many bumper stickers, but we have the opportunity to be the change that we wish to see. If we want to turn the temperature down, we get to be a part of making that happen. Now, I can hear your responses, because we've already had a pre-talk, and for the last couple of weeks, the last couple of months, almost every subject, no matter what we talk about on a Sunday here, somehow manages to get brought back around to some form of political scenario or conversation, because let's face it, it is tops of mind for all of us right now. We're thinking about it a lot. It occupies a lot of energy. It's exhausting. How do we turn that temperature down? It's hard to do that when we already have such a polarized view of the other. There was a study that found that most Americans, 71%, think that we will see a civil war in the next year when asked by surveyors. And what was interesting is both parties, or people who align themselves with both parties, thought the other party was just as likely as the other of inciting violence and contributing to that. Now, we don't need to get into the specifics of that, but what I find interesting is that we're not alone in thinking that the other is the problem here. How do you move forward when you have two groups of people, each who see the other as the antithesis of everything that is necessary to move the country forward? That's tough, isn't it? I don't think there's easy answers to this. If there were, we would be talking about and doing it. I think, I suspect that it's going to be really granular. It's going to be very grassroots. It's going to be very complicated and messy, because it's going to happen one conversation, one relationship at a time. We, as a society, as human beings, from the time that we could talk, have assigned blame for the problems that we have to someone else. If you believe the biblical account of Adam and Eve, it started out even then when Adam said, it wasn't my fault, it was her fault. She's the one who gave me the apple. Today, is it Will Smith or is it Chris Rock? Is it Amber Heard or is it Johnny Depp? We have so many different teams that we like to align ourselves with, because there is something reassuring about finding that we're on a team and to find that there's other people like us. And we find reassurance not only in finding our team, but in talking crap about the other team. It makes us feel better about our team. It makes us feel more reassured. And the more that we point out all the things that are wrong with them, the better we feel about ourselves. It's a strange predicament. Our brains like simplicity. But this is not a simple situation that we find ourselves in, isn't it? Occam's razor says that given the choice, we will tend to prefer the simplest answer for situations. In a study that was published in the book Complicits by Max Bazerman, he did a study of businesses and asked these business leaders to, through the Harvard Business School, he took a group of business executives and he asked them to review a case of business fraud and to point out the core problems that happened in this case. And even though it was a very complicated case with many solutions, 62 of the 78 businesses wrote only one cause. This is Occam's razor at work. When we view complicated situations, we tend to reduce it down to the simplest and oftentimes a binary solution, because our brains like binaries. Our brains like an either or. We are obviously right, so therefore this position over here is wrong. And we like to divide it into simplistic terms. It makes our brains feel good to know that we've got it all figured out. But if we're honest, we know that it's a lot more complicated. And most complicated situations don't just have one easy answer. There's a lot of things that go into that. And we're so quick to point out all of the faults in our opposing viewpoints. This morning, I found myself quoting Jesus more than I had in a while, because I've come from a Christian background, and Christians are supposed to be the embodiment of love. Jesus, in his Beatitudes, gave us some pretty counterintuitive advice about how to engage with people who are different than us. He said crazy things about loving enemies and turning the other cheek. Crazy, audacious advice that really doesn't work in the real world. So what does it look like to follow the advice of Jesus? Jesus also said that when you're looking at somebody else and trying to remove the splinter from their eye, he said, maybe stop for a second, take a look in the mirror, because you've got a bigger one in your own eye. How do we turn down the temperature? I think we do it first by recovering our sense of common humanity, by coming back to the things that draw us together. And I'm going to be a bit pie in the sky and a bit philosophical and a bit esoteric in my advice and realize that walking this out is very, very difficult. It's difficult for me, and I have to talk about this. I still wrestle with this on a regular basis. I mentioned that a couple winters ago, Lisa and I took our RV and we spent the Southwest or spent the winter traveling the Southwest, and we had the opportunity to meet some fascinating people, as you do when you're traveling the road and you're meeting other nomads who are living out of their RV. You meet some interesting people. One of the things that Lisa and I enjoyed the most and we talked about were the conversations that we would have 2 or 3 hours long around the fire, only to find out, or maybe not even to find out at all, that that person that we were just getting along great with probably voted for somebody that I would have been repulsed by. Well, wait a second, I thought I wasn't supposed to like this person. Sure, they have a few things that are way different than me, but I found that there were so many things that we had in common. The simple fact of the matter is that without outside prompting, without every side trying to pit us against one another, we, more often than not, when placed into a conversation one-on-one with somebody who is not like us, given enough time, we'll start to find common ground. Because yes, we do have that antagonistic, divisive seed within us. I would not go so far as to say that it is that sin nature, but we all have that same propensity to want to alienate the other. But I believe that deeper still is this sense of commonality that draws us together, even with people who are so incredibly different. Can we see and acknowledge the suffering in others? Can we ask the questions to learn what are the stories behind the stories? Now, we brought this up this morning, and somebody pointed out, rightly so, well, that's easy. If you were to ask and why they believe certain things, they would start quoting conspiracy theories and Fox News and all this crazy stuff, and what are you supposed to do to that? It's a valid question, right? How do you argue crazy when you don't agree on the common truths? This is where we find ourselves. And what I'm encouraging us to do is to go deeper than the things that we're voting about, as important as they are, the issues that we're voting about, as important as they are. And by all means, I'm telling you this morning, please hear me, I am not saying set aside social activism. I'm not saying there is not a time or a place to rise up and to say enough is enough and that we're not going back and that we're going to move forward as a country. That almost goes without saying, especially within this group. But what I'm saying is we also have the opportunity to do more than just make political changes in our country, because, God willing, if we get to the other side of this election, and we move forward, and maybe we avoid, or maybe there's more political violence, but in a year or so down the road from now, there's going to be another half of this country, or almost half, that their views are not represented, and they feel excluded. They feel to be the other. If we're ever going to move forward, how do we come together? And I would say this. Those of us who call ourselves spiritual, those of us who claim to have some form of spirituality that guides our decisions, we should be leading the conversation on this. And I would dare say, especially those of us at C3. You see, we claim to have values like common humanity. Common humanity, which we say we respect the dignity and worth of every individual. Every individual. To love someone as a human being, even though we are so diametrically opposed to the things that they do,
Alan Watts says this. He says, things are as they are. Looking out into the universe at night, we make no comparisons between right and wrong stars, nor between well and beautifully arranged constellations. It is simply an acceptance of life as it is. And sure, we could try to play the blame game. We could try to compare ourselves to other countries. Any one of us in here could come up with a list of 25 different things that we could implement tomorrow to make this country a better place. We talk about this, we think about this, because as Americans, this is something that is regularly coming up. But if we go beyond our identity politically or nationally and talk about our shared or common humanity, we begin to realize that those other dividing factors matter less and less. Lisa and I liked a show for a while. I believe this was Hulu. Anybody watch Last Man on Earth with Will Forte? A couple of you did. It's a fantastic show. The premise is quite simple. There's an apocalypse, and Will Forte, who is also an SNL alum, who's a hilarious actor, finds himself as the last man on Earth, or so he thinks. And then as time goes on, there's a couple of other survivors. And the humor is, of course, when you find yourself the last two or three people on Earth, what do you do when the people that you share this planet with are people that you would rather just be on the opposite side of the planet from? And that's a pretty real metaphor. It's a pretty real question, because that's where we're at now, right? Are we only moving forward where those that we disagree with, we move further and further apart? Or can we be the change that we want to see? Can we embody love? Now, when I talked about this in pre-talk, I said I wanted to take this from this big political conversation, these national talking points that the commentators are discussing on a daily basis. I want to bring this right down to the nitty-gritty, the granular. I'm talking about your cousin, your uncle, your son, your daughter, your neighbor, who you know is not like you in all the ways that you probably would deem most important. And you know there's nothing you can say that is going to change their mind. And they know there's nothing they're going to say that is going to change your mind. What do you do? How do you move forward? If we have the courage to remember our common humanity, we have to begin by seeing that person first as a fellow human being, created with worth and value in and of themselves that is separate from who they voted for, what they believe. And maybe a question that we need to ask ourselves, can we say in our heart of hearts, that person, and maybe you can, for the purpose of this example, think of and put a name in there or face, that person that you're thinking of, that person who voted that way, that person who has been especially obnoxious, that family member, that coworker. Can you say that you love them as a fellow human being? And can you love them unconditionally, regardless of whether or not they ever change their mind on the things that matter according to you? Maybe not, and that's okay to be honest, but that's a start. What is love if not unconditional? Can we offer unconditional love to those who are not like us? Can we? Here's what Ram Dass said. I found this quote later after I had already sent in the quotes. As a matter of fact, the two quotes that I really wanted to put in the bulletin came after the fact. But I'll try to share this maybe on Facebook or something later on. Ram Dass said it this way, and this was so, so good. So hear this. He says, if you are in truth attempting to make this world a better place to live in, the most leverage you have is not on other people. It's on yourself. You make yourself a statement of love. You make yourself a statement of truth. You make yourself a statement of consciousness. That is what changes the nature of the predicament that the human race finds itself in. If you're getting angry because the world isn't loving enough, the paradox is just laughable. If we're getting angry at how angry the world is, we're only contributing to more anger. If we bring peace, however, into a place where there is division and anger, and if we respond not out of a need to be right, not out of a desire to win the conversation, but out of our common humanity to see the other person as a fellow human being, as a person worthy of love, that's how change happens. That's where it starts. We've talked in the past about this one small step, and I would encourage you, if you haven't already, to participate in that. There's a process through StoryCorps, which is a national organization that has worked with NPR, and they are working with our own local affiliate, WGVU. And if you go to WGVU, I believe it's .org/onesmallstep. We also have had that in the emails and whatnot. I've signed up, and I've been matched with my first conversation, which is about a month away. What it does is simply do what we're talking about this in a guided way. You fill out all of your background, not all of your background, you don't have to tell everything, but you share as much information as is relevant to the conversation, beliefs, backgrounds, but they ask for some more humanizing details. Details about yourself. Have you experienced any losses? Do you have any health issues? Different things like that. And you're matched in a conversation with somebody else who probably sees different than you on one or many issues. Maybe politically, it may be something else entirely. It could be religion. But you're engaging in a conversation, and this is backed by social science that finds that when we humanize someone that we disagree with, changes happen in both of the brains. Cognitive changes happen when we stop seeing others through the lens of the other and begin to find the common ground. To recognize that that person who voted that way, that we're so appalled by, also has a child who has that same medical condition that your child has. And before long, you're talking and you're finding this common ground and you're finding it just a little bit tougher to hold the anger and hostility. And you find that love begins to build bridges where once we spread. I want to end with this quote, and I'm going to invite the guys to come back up here as we close, because this says it better than anything I could have said. As a matter of fact, if I could have just simply come up and read this morning, this would have been enough. If anybody tuned in on Friday and saw Amanda Gorman's poem, Amanda Gorman, of course, is the black poet that gave a wonderful recitation during President Biden's inauguration. She wrote a poem called This Sacred Scene, and I just want to read a short excerpt as we close. We are one family, regardless of religion, class, or color. For what defines a patriot is not just our love of liberty, but our love for one another. This is loud in our country's call. Because while we all love freedom, it is love that frees us all. Empathy emancipates, making us greater than hate or vanity. That is the American promise. Powerful, divided we cannot endure, but united we can endeavor to humanize our democracy and endear democracy
to humanity. Thank you for sharing this time and this space with me this morning. Namaste.